Everybody, this is Dwayne Johnson, and I'm here to tell you about a new documentary podcast series titled What Really Happened, narrated by award-winning documentary filmmaker Andrew Jenks in coordination with our company, Seven Bucks Productions.
Muhammad Ali saved a man from committing suicide.
I got the whole world.
In 2007, Britney Spears' life became a train wreck.
Next thing I knew, all her hair was off.
Was Michael Jordan pushed out of basketball because of his gambling problem?
You know, I'm doing fine. I'm strong mentally, I'm strong physically.
Did any of these happen the way we were told? I'm Andrew Jenks, a documentary filmmaker, and along with executive producers Dwayne Johnson and Danny Garcia, I go on a rogue investigation.
This series will look deep into the unknown sides of historic news stories and then ask, what really happened?
You can subscribe and listen to What Really Happened now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
The Cowboys use Dak and defense to knock off the Chiefs. Kirk Cousins pulls off a miracle behind an overmatched offensive line in Seattle. And we had a lot of haymakers thrown and bodies slammed in a wild week 9. We're breaking it all down on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We are pretty much through week 9 at this point. I suppose we have one game left that we won't refer to. But Andy, lots of fighting, lots of fisticuffs this week.
Yeah, good ones, really good ones. Ejections, brawls. Do you think the NFL likes that or dislikes that? Like in a private moment, what do you think Roger Goodell, if he's thinking just numbers, what do you think?
I think they are slightly positive in that. I think if it, you know, whatever, if there's five of these every week, that becomes problematic. I think it's almost like the hockey fighting type of thing where, you know, you have a game like down at Jacksonville, not a terribly competitive game, but hey, now you got a highlight to show. Now you got something to talk about the Jaguars-Bengals, which we will get to later in the show because two really good players fought.
Yeah. The one I think they probably don't like, I thought it was like thuggish behavior by Mike Evans on the cheap shot of Lattimore. Like that was a real punk move. That one I don't know if the league would. I mean, that wasn't even a fight. That was just an ambush.
Yep. We'll get to that one too. And that was, I agree with you. I have a lot of issues with the actions of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers right there. But we'll get to that game in a little bit.
Number one.
We're going to start topic number one. We're going to go to Dallas. Cowboys knock off the Chiefs. This was one where it seemed like all week the Cowboys were not going to have Ezekiel Elliott. They end up having him. That sort of skewed some things in their favor, obviously. They're a better team when Ezekiel Elliott is in the lineup. He did not have a monster day. He had had back-to-back big games. You know, Chiefs were obviously, they were keying on him. Dak Prescott kind of took this one over. It was Dak Prescott and it was the defense. Prescott just continues to... he just gets better and better, and he's extending plays. He's making big throws after extending plays. I think they're going to be all right, even if they are going to be without Elliott for the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's been a few times that Prescott's done this now. We wondered after last season. We said he had perfect conditions. That doesn't last in the NFL. Something will change at some point, and we'll learn more about him. And we've kind of seen the change. The running game's been up and down, and Dak Prescott has carried the team in a few important contests. I think I was surprised Dallas didn't run the ball a little better. I didn't think Kansas City matched up very well with him. You know, they had that trouble against those three receiver sets in run defense. They play that lighter dime defense. That's been well documented. And Elliott this year has been particularly productive running out of three receiver sets. And Dallas has a pretty expansive scheme out of some of those three receiver formations. But today it wasn't a big deal. They had to rely on Prescott making plays against that dime defense.
Yeah, and I didn't even think it was really a matter of Elliott not running well. I thought the Chiefs, clearly they were focused on stopping him, and they did a relatively good job of that. Elliott did create some yards where they were really not available. He ended up 27 for 93, but this was Dak Prescott. And you know what? This was also the pass rush again, and I've been wondering about this pass rush because, I mean, to be honest, they've dominated some bad offensive lines, and I was curious to see what they do against a decent group here in Kansas City, and they were very good today, and they completely kept the Chiefs off schedule this entire game.
Yeah, it's better. David Irving coming back has been a real boost for that pass rush, and he's moved to defensive tackle. I would not have guessed that would be his position. He doesn't really have that body type.
Yeah.
But his athleticism has translated very well there. And I think when you play the Chiefs, your pass rush stems almost from your coverage because Kansas City is such a highly schemed offense. And Alex Smith is so good when he's getting the ball out early. And if you're going to eliminate that, you have to get some kind of press coverage on that. You have to win in your coverage to prevent the QB from getting the ball out early. So Dallas's secondary and the way they matched up and the aggression they played there, that's also going to factor in anytime you get a pass rush on the Chiefs.
Yeah, and look, this game, it seemed like it started to swing. The big highlight at the end of the first half was the 56-yard catch-and-run Hail Mary for the Chiefs to end the half, which was just a... I always wondered why teams don't do that, try the catch-and-run. I guess if you got a guy who can reach the end zone, you just chuck it to the end zone. But I always wondered, because you're so far back on your heels if you're a defense... And if you just get a couple blockers up there, then all you need to do is have a guy who can make one or two tacklers miss.
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of that because I've always, when I see it on film, I always think, why do they even do the catch and run? It's just padding numbers, I guess, but these have no chance. But after seeing that Tyreek Hill play today, my mindset has shifted a little because let's say the defense drops, it's usually eight guys back. Well, You're not playing against all eight guys. Those guys are spread over the width of the field. So You have to really make about three or four of them miss. That's hard to do. We're not going to see this often, but that's no different than throwing a jump ball and having three or four defenders against one receiver on a jump ball. So if you have a guy like Tyreek Hill, and most teams do not, so we have to factor that in too. Mm-hmm. But I think we might see more teams do this now just because finally someone had some noted success with it.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is with that play, I mean, look, defenders aren't used to playing like that. And, you know, there were guys who never got involved in the play on the right side of the field because it's, you know, they don't want to get sucked in and all of a sudden Tyreek Hill bounces out and sprints to the opposite pylon. So they're sort of sitting back and containing, and the other guys are containing, and DeMarcus Robinson clears out two guys, Travis Kelce takes out Byron Jones, and then Tyreek Hill basically just has to make two guys miss, which he did. But, they did that, and then the Chiefs came out. They got a touchdown to open the second half, and it looked like, momentum, for lack of a better word. But it looked like things were sort of starting to go their way here, and the Cowboys came right back and really dominated the last 25 minutes of this game or so.
So now the Chiefs have lost 3 out of 4 after being the lone undefeated team for a short while there. So do we feel differently about them now?
I guess it depends on how you felt about them to begin with. I mean, they never, to me at least, they never felt dominant. They were great in the opener, and I think that stuck with a lot of people because when you go into Foxborough and you severely outplay the Patriots, that's exciting, and that's something that will get people's attention. But... I'm not sure they were ever, especially without Eric Berry, I'm not sure they were necessarily better than they were, last year. A few more big plays. They're a little bit more dynamic offensively, but they're not quite the same defensive unit that they were.
And they're such a highly schemed offense that you can beat a highly schemed offense because there is no perfect scheme. If there were, every team would run that scheme every snap. We say that all the time. So at some point, as our friend Greg Cosell says, it will be third and long in the NFL. And what you really mean by that, and it's not exactly third and long, but at some point, you have to rely on your quarterback in the NFL. It might not be every single game, and a lot of times it is almost every game, but talent takes over. And I'm not disparaging Alex Smith at all, and I'm not saying, oh, he's the reason they lost the game. But Kansas City is a highly schemed offense, and that can only take you so far. Your players have to make plays. And so that's going to be what determines if they are another 11-5 team that gets to the second round or if they're a real contender.
Number two.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some quarterbacks who made plays in topic number two right now. This was Washington goes up to Seattle and wins one of the weirdest games I can really remember. I was shocked to actually look at the box score after this game that Seattle had 437 yards because everything, as usual with them, was just so uneven offensively, and it ended up just being all Russell Wilson. And this offense is starting to remind me of it. I had written this in my Sunday column. It's starting to remind me of it. It's almost like basketball where, you know, you don't have such specific plays drawn out. You have more sort of a general system laid out, and the coach rolls the ball out and says, okay, you're the point guard, go do your thing. And that's kind of what they're doing right now. And Russell Wilson can only do so much. They don't really have any running game outside of Wilson, and they just have no down-to-down consistency with what they're doing in the passing game.
And it's been that way for a few years now. And when we say someone's inconsistent, remember, that means good and bad. That doesn't just mean bad. And so we've seen the good, we've seen the bad, but overall, that's not going to be good enough. And Seattle, I agree with you, Gary, and normally I would take umbrage with that kind of statement saying, well, they just kind of go out there and play, because I don't believe that's true in the NFL, but I know exactly what you're saying in this case, and I think that is spot on with Seattle. They don't just literally go out there and run around, but it has that feel to it, and it's not all because Russell Wilson's that style of player. In fact, he's become a little less of that style of player, at least relative to where he was early in his career. They just don't have an identity. If this team's not running the ball well, and with this offensive line and these backs, they have not been running the ball well, they really don't have an identity. They don't have anything else they can go off of. They have some great passing concepts. They do some nice things with Baldwin on wheel routes and rub routes. They'll put Graham on the backside of trips. But those are not foundational elements. The running game is the foundation here. That's what complements Russell Wilson well, and the running game has been up and down really since Marshawn Lynch left, and that's not going to change given the changes they've made along the offensive line and all the things they're trying there. That's not going to change until they get that offensive line figured out.
Yeah, the number of plays that are, you know, Wilson takes a snap and immediately it's just because, you know, they can't pass protect for him. So immediately it's run around and he's, you know, sort of weaving his way through the pocket as opposed to standing in any sort of pocket that is formed because the pocket doesn't really exist at all. And, you know, it ends up well sometimes and sometimes it does not. Obviously, they were, as well as the offensive inconsistency, they were also hampered by the three missed field goals. And boy, Blair Walsh, this was rough, and you start to worry about Blair Walsh again. He missed three; they were all inside 50, and obviously that ended up being huge here. But this was also Washington could not handle the Seahawks up front with the offensive line the Redskins were trotting out. This was a complete mismatch, and Kirk Cousins was really just helpless all day. And then all of a sudden, on the last drive of the game, they pull out a play, and it's Josh Doctson, the first-round pick, who really hasn't made a big impact yet, makes a huge diamond catch down the sideline to set up the winning score. And that's kind of exactly what they needed, and it just seemed like there was absolutely no chance it was going to happen in this one.
And let's just take the 30,000-foot perspective here, because there's no way Jay Gruden's going to go in and emphasize any of these negative things when they watch this film this week. What he's going to tell his guys is, hey, we went into Seattle with four backup offensive linemen without our best wide receiver, our slot guy, Jamison Crowder, and without our best player, our tight end, Jordan Reed, and we won on the road. That's all. I mean, sometimes it's that simple. You almost don't even want to watch this film because these were not the real Redskins out there. These were the week two, second half preseason Redskins almost, with the quarterback still in there, and they got the job done. That's a remarkable accomplishment no matter how ugly it is.
It is. And I mean, credit Jay Gruden, credit Kirk Cousins. I mean, it was just so unlikely that they were going to, the Seahawks had come down, finally gotten their two touchdowns in the fourth quarter, and they were up 14-10. There were 90 seconds left, and it just seemed absolutely impossible that the Redskins were going to come back down and score, and that's what they did.
Number three.
Let's go on to topic number three, Andy. This was the Sunday nighter, the Dolphins and the Raiders. First of all, I can't believe they play on this turf down in Miami. I don't know what they're going to do about that because it's presumably just going to get worse and worse as the college football and the NFL season go on. And Lord knows what they'll be playing on in December. It'll just be a sandbox, I guess. But this one was kind of ugly. I guess we'll start with the Dolphins side because I want to talk about the Dolphins offense a little bit. They got Devontae Parker back, and you kind of wondered, and Jay Cutler was obviously back under center tonight, and you kind of wondered, okay, is this when they are going to get more aggressive downfield and sort of try and open things up a little bit more? But they were very conservative. There was a lot of stuff underneath. It was a lot from the backs and Julius Thomas, a lot of catch-and-run stuff with some success with the running backs, but they really just didn't have any sort of downfield element to their offense until the until the garbage time drive.
Yeah, well, it was a little more than garbage time. I mean, it was a competitive drive.
Garbage-ish time.
Late Raiders were loose in some of their zones, but when the ball got across the 50, I think Miami beat them on that. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Look, this Dolphin offense has not been good all season long. Tonight they did show rhythm. Having Parker back helped, although he really wasn't a big factor in the game. He had the early catch against mm-hmm. McDonald, and then that was about it. But he does balance the formations differently. He's your ex-ISO receiver. In Miami, they do more with trips receivers than any team in the league. In fact, I can tell you, Gase would prefer to play out of 3-by-1 formations every snap if that was realistic. I mean, he loves that formation. So when you have a guy to be the one in that, the ex-ISO, mm-hmm. you're going to be better. So having Parker out did hinder them a lot. I don't think Gase trusts that offensive line. And we saw the quick game tonight, and that's the nature of Miami's system. And Chris Collinsworth did a great job of pointing out with that quick passing game comes those quick set pass protection. In other words, instead of dropping back as a pass protector, what they call a vertical set or sometimes an angle yep. set, depending on which way you want to block them, instead of doing that, you do a quick set and you step into the pass rusher. You can only do that if the ball is coming out quickly because it's a high-risk, high-reward kind of blocking. But the odd part about it is it's high-risk, high-reward, but it's also easier for the offensive lineman. You're the aggressor. You're not reacting. And so it's a very different way to block a Khalil Mack and a Bruce Irvin. They did that all night long. And when they weren't able to do that and they had the backup right tackle Sam Young in the game, that's when Khalil Mack came to life and we saw the pass protection issues rise up and the offense sputtered a little bit. But overall, we're still talking about a lot of pieces that are not in place here. What's the running game like? Does Gase trust the pass protection? I don't think he does. Every third down and long, he's just seeding for punts. This offense is nowhere near where it wants to be yet. Tonight was at least a step in the right direction. I don't think Gase will be thrilled watching the film, though.
Yeah. Well, let's look at Oakland's side of the ball here. A lot of Jared Cook tonight.
They knew well, Kiko Alonso's the guy teams like to throw against in coverage.
Yeah.
And he's interesting. He's almost like these Dolphins offensive linemen. When he can be the aggressor, he's a very good player. He's a downhill runner. He's pretty agile. He's nimble. When you get him reacting, though, he's never been a great mentally reactive player. That's not to say he's not a smart player. He just doesn't seem to process that same way, though. He needs to mm-hmm. be the aggressor. Well, when you're a zone defense, that can be difficult. And Oakland knows how to dictate mismatches and matchups against the linebackers in zone defense. All offenses do. And it was apparent they felt Alonso was the guy they could go after. The other thing is they went after those safeties a little bit with some designer shot plays. Not a lot, but the ones they did do, the one to Holton, those worked as well.
Yeah.
So Miami's a predictable defense in an okay way. You know how they're going to line up. You know how they're going to play. They believe they can out-execute you. Well, if they don't get their pass rush home, then you have a chance to out-execute them, and that's what happened tonight.
I feel like it. And as you mentioned, Johnny Holton had the 44-yard touchdown on a designer deep shot there. And I guess it's just sort of encouraging to see the Raiders starting to work some of these things back into the offense that maybe wasn't there when they were really struggling, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, they're moving their receivers around more, and it really starts with Amari Cooper and getting him going, and he's really become a slot receiver for them. He struggled against press coverage last year too, Gary, down the stretch. Mm-hmm. Nobody really noticed because Oakland was winning. The stats were looking good across the board, but Cooper's stats were not great across the board, and there were times where he really had issues there. And that leads to inconsistency. And then when you factor in the 50-50 chance of him dropping the ball every time he's targeted, now you're looking at big time inconsistency. So to ameliorate some of that, they've put him in the slot. I think that's helped. That also dictates matchups more, defines the read for Carr. Slot receiver against zone coverage will always be a good one. Miami's a zone defense. So I think Todd Downing, frankly, I think he's doing a better job than he did early in the season now at offensive coordinator.
All right. Well, things looking up for Oakland a little bit. And I guess everyone's still kind of in it as far as the wild card race goes. Not that we have to talk playoff picture at this point, but it's certainly pretty wide open in the AFC right now. All right, Andy, hang on one second before we can move on. They say in life there are no guarantees. They say there's no sure thing. Well, I'm here to tell you there might just be one exception. In 1924, Husky started making things for people who make things, and they did it with common sense. That meant adding function, never frills, and making tools that stood the tests of time. 93 years later, Husky is still making quality-crafted, durable tools, and Husky stands by their hand tools for life, so they gave their hand tools a lifetime warranty. Like the Husky Ratchet, with a 100-position ratcheting design and a 10% longer handle than standard ratchets to do what other ratchets can't, or the virtually unbreakable Husky Flashlight with the ability to withstand a 30-foot drop and work in up to 1 meter of water submersion. Both guaranteed for a lifetime, but built so you won't need it. Now, that's a pretty sure thing. And to Husky, that's common sense. Husky. Common sense tools since 1924 with hand tools guaranteed for a lifetime. Found only at the Home Depot.
Number four.
Okay, so topic number four. This is the Panthers and the Falcons. This was my favorite game of the day. This Panthers offense, Mike Shula just broke out some just ridiculous, gadgety series of stuff that they really haven't used in the past. It was creative. It had the Falcons' fast defense on their heels, and if not for Keanu Neal basically taking the ball from Jonathan Stewart twice in the first half, the Panthers might have run away with this one. They sort of ran out of steam late. I think they sort of ran out of things in their bag of tricks, but this was a neat game plan by Mike Shula, and this was a fun game to watch, and the Panthers, they got it done, and they got it done with a ton of work on the ground in this one. They only threw it 24 times.
Panther fans, take a deep sigh of relief there, because that's a team built around the running game. It always will be because of Cam Newton's strengths and weaknesses. He's such a good running threat himself. And their running game had done nothing. Their base, foundational running game, take Newton out of it, talking about running backs and the power and the counter and the stuff they do, that had been doing nothing in the past few weeks. So to show up against a divisional foe and find your running game again, and that's the fun of division games, Gary. You know these opponents so well. Atlanta, mm-hmm. There's another defense. They don't really try to outthink you. They're just going to line up and play. That's why they draft all these fast guys, because they just want to play faster than you. Gadgets are a great thing to run against a defense like that, because you're right, it gets those fast guys on their heels, or when the gadget misdirection gets them to bite, they bite harder because they play so much faster. So that's a good idea that Carolina had, and their offense is naturally conducive to that. They can build in a lot of options and a lot of variables within their play designs.
I would just say the Panthers opened the second half with a Statue of Liberty play. And I was weeping. I had tears of joy coming out. And it went for 14 yards. It worked. Curtis Samuel coming around from the left side around the right end. It was awesome.
Finally, I get the sense they're starting to figure him out a little bit. Samuel was not a factor the first 6-7 weeks of the season. We're seeing him become a little more involved. I'm not sure he has a true NFL position. But yeah, if they're going to be willing to do these gadget plays, that's going to be his best chance to succeed.
Well, it seems a little Tavon Austin-y, and I don't know if that's an insult or a compliment, but it just
I don't
seems
either.
Like that's what he is.
Yeah, Austin's a fascinating player because he plays about 15 snaps a game, but on at least 12 or 13 of them, he'll be the main focal point of the play. The play will be designed around him. Whether the ball goes to him or not, the play is going to be designed around Austin. Curtis Samuel might be that kind of guy. I don't know if he's quite got Austin's dynamic, shifty, and quickness, though. I haven't seen enough of him to say yay or nay on that, though.
No, that's fair enough. The Panthers also ran a really neat play in the red zone that involved a left-handed pitch from Cam to Christian McCaffrey, and it was a legit, like, you know, he had to really push the thing out there like 10 yards to get it to McCaffrey. But it worked. They had some neat stuff. And again, look, they just dealt Kelvin Benjamin, so maybe they're going to be something a little bit different on offense going forward. They still have Funchess, no Greg Olsen, no Kelvin Benjamin. This isn't quite the same group of weapons that they had coming into the year. As far as the Falcons go, it looked like they were going to get it going early in this game. It looked like they sort of picked up where they left off in that Jets game. And I thought they were good in that Jets game. They just they had a couple of drops in the weather, and it felt like, if they clean that stuff up, they're sort of, I'm not going to say they're going to be back to doing what they were a year ago, but it seems like they're a lot closer to that than sort of the panicky, everyone's, freaking out about Steve Sarkisian, vibe that was going on there after the Patriots game.
Well, I thought Matt Ryan's film against the Jets was his best of the season so far. I was thoroughly impressed with that game, and there's no reason to not get back. A lot of teams have had injuries this year. Guys have changed, whatever. You know, the personnel is the same here, Gary. And they've got a veteran quarterback, a good offensive line, maybe even a great offensive line with Jake Matthews continuing to improve at left tackle. A good right tackle, Ryan Schrader. Most teams are not secure on both edges. They have the league's most dominant wide receiver, and they have two of the most dynamic running backs. There's no reason, to get back on track. You know, they need to be on track yesterday. There's no reason they shouldn't be getting 30 points a game.
Yeah, and what came back to bite them today was some situational stuff. They, in the first half, they got stuffed on a 4th-and-1, sort of right on that borderline field goal range right there, and at the time they were protecting a 10-0 lead, and after they got stuffed, that's when the Panthers came down and got their first touchdown, and Panthers ended up adding another one late in the half to make it 14-10 going into halftime. And then Falcons came out in the second half. They ended up 3rd-and-inches. They ended up doing play action and not coming through there. They had a 2nd-and-inches where Matt Ryan, and I hate to bring up last February, but it's another case of Matt Ryan holding the ball, should have gotten rid of it, instead takes a sack, puts him in 3rd-and-6, and they don't convert there. And the one that everyone's going to be talking about tomorrow was Julio Jones just dropped an absolute, probably the easiest touchdown he'll ever have, and it was shocking to see that happen. And he was a little bit banged up all day, and obviously he's a wonderful player, but this was a very costly drop. It was one that they needed down 10, and they had a very impressive drive. They got the ball with 5:26 left. They went 92 yards in a little more than 2 minutes and 7 plays to pull themselves back into this one, but couldn't get it all the way back.
And you just chucked that one up to the sometimes it happens file. I mean, Julio Jones is not he's not Amari Cooper, where these drops are a weekly issue with him. That's just, it's bad timing and bad luck.
Yeah. No, it was, honestly, it was so stunning because it was him. It would have been stunning no matter who it was, but it was especially stunning when you saw it was number 11.
Number 5.
Topic number 5, Andy. We'll go Eagles-Broncos here, and this was the Carson Wentz, we'll call it the MVP campaign, because now Peter King has officially dubbed him the first half MVP. We'll have the whole staff vote later this week, but Peter has dubbed him.
Well, you just gave away the best part of the vote, though. I mean, that's the big tease, is who's Peter King's MVP.
Well, Peter, everyone's going to see that. By the time this podcast comes out, everyone will have already seen that Peter King had dubbed Carson Wentz MVP. But we're going to do like the full staff vote. So it'll be like, it'll be a little election.
See, this is the problem with the teams on bye week. We forget about Tom Brady because Carson Wentz is the guy we saw most recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure Peter wrote that article at 4:30 this afternoon.
Well, I mean, he's got a job to do. Like, Carson Wentz has had a phenomenal season. I'm not going to say anything bad about it. He is a tremendous player, and we've been saying that since before he came into the NFL. So this is nothing surprising to see him progress this way and to see how expansive the Eagles' offense has become. If we're talking MVP, I think Tom Brady's had the best season of his career that I can remember. I mean, there's a lot of seasons you have to go back through, and maybe 2007's one you could argue about, that Randy Moss 50-touchdown Brady year. But those are the two guys, aren't they, Gary? Is there anybody else that would be in the midway discussion for MVP?
Yeah, we had a discussion. We do our Monday editors meeting with Mark Moravec and Adam Duerson, and Jenny Brentis and Tim Rohan usually sit in, Connor Orr, Kalen Kaler. But we had a conversation that was so dumb the other day that I it was one of those, like, I'm living in a cuckoo clock type of things where we had talked about, who's going to be midseason MVP for our midseason report. And I just kind of said, well, it's Brady. There's not really a big debate at this point, is there? And there was, honest to God, swell of support for Kareem Hunt. And Kareem Hunt's been great. But Kareem Hunt as MVP, it was insane. And, like, people are sending in their top fives now. I haven't seen anyone with Kareem Hunt on a ballot. But it was crazy talk.
See, here's, yeah, and he's had a very nice season as well. And I think I'm putting together an all-pro team tomorrow, and I started it tonight, kind of getting going, and I think I've got him number two or three at running back. He's had a very nice year. Here's what statistics and advanced grading with, this it can't capture. And I'm starting to open my mind a little more to the grading stuff, but here's what it can't capture and why I know you can't go all in on it. There's no way to quantify what you ask a player to do. His role, his mental responsibilities, his physical responsibilities, where he's lining up and how that relates to everything you're doing, that's all difficult to quantify. And when you put on the film each week, Kareem Hunt's a puzzle piece and a very good offense, a puzzle piece and a great puzzle. That's what Alex Smith is as well. Travis Kelce's a little bit more than that for them. So is Tyreek Hill, based on how you see them playing and what they're being asked to do. The MVPs, the quarterbacks are so far and away more valuable. It's almost like you need two separate awards here. And Brady and Wentz have been so much better than the other quarterbacks in the NFL. I think Matthew Stafford's been up there too. But Wentz has surpassed Stafford in my mind for accomplishment this season so far. You can't have a reasonable discussion that doesn't involve saying the quarterback's the most valuable player, especially when the quarterbacks are playing this well.
Yep. No, absolutely. I think it's Brady is the clear-cut one, Wentz is the clear-cut two. But that means we're not knocking Wentz. We're just saying he's the second best player in the NFL, which is very good. That means he's better than...
Or second most valuable
valuable.
Because that's also the debate, right? Is who are we going best? Are we going valuable? And what's your definition of valuable? And everyone's got a little bit of a different one.
So, Carson Wentz's newest teammate in this one, Jay Ajayi, and he didn't play a huge role. I mean, this game was a blowout. They hammered the Broncos. 51-23 was the final, and this one was what was it? At halftime, it was 31-9. Broncos scored on their opening drive, and then the Eagles started to pull away after that. Kicked a field goal, I should say, on their opening drive. So, Jay Ajayi, he gets dealt. Last year, he had all those long runs for Miami, and that sort of... it didn't necessarily skew his numbers. He still had some good numbers, even if you take away the 70-yarder and the 60-yarder and whatever else he had. He didn't have a run longer than 21 yards for the Dolphins this year. And his fifth carry today, he ends up going 46 yards for a touchdown on a play where the Broncos did not defend it very well at all, but also some nice blocking by the Eagles. But in your mind, Eddie, how does Ajayi... how does he fit with what the Eagles do? Is he that much of an upgrade over what they had, the sort of LeGarrette Blount, Wendell Smallwood, Corey Clement committee in there?
Well, I think you put Blunt in his own part of the conversation, because they do different things with Blunt than they do with those other guys. And he's more of their, they put him in their power running game. That doesn't mean, oh, Blunt's the biggest, so he's just going to run his shoulders through guys and get 5 yards. That's not necessarily what you mean by that. It's just the formations he runs out of. Those tend to be the overloaded tight end formation, sometimes six offensive linemen in their case. And they do pull blockers and all that stuff with Blunt inside zone, where he's running behind double teams. And Blunt's always such a hard player to analyze, because he's not slow, or he's not fast. He kind of looks slow. He's not particularly nimble. He's not as powerful as his build suggests he would be. And yet he gained 6 or 7 yards on runs that should be gaining 3 or 4. I mean, he's a good player who the bad attributes and a good player. And it's a hard one to understand. Ajayi's got good attributes, and he can be a good player. And one of the issues with him, and people remember, Ajayi got left home early last season. He wasn't, they sat out in weeks one, at least maybe week two, certainly week one, because he didn't have his head screwed on right. And one of the issues with Ajayi and Adam Gase in Miami was Adam Gase runs a zone scheme. Outside zone is their running scheme. Ajayi believed himself to be a gap scheme runner, running behind man-to-man blocking. We just talked about those pull blocks, those double teams that Blunt does. That's where Ajayi thinks he fits best. And I don't think he – my guess is he probably never fully fit in or bought into what Miami was doing. He'll buy into what Philadelphia is doing, because they have such a diverse running game. They're going to find plays that work for him and that he's going to be comfortable with. And they'll probably, I doubt they bring a guy in mid-season and tell him to run stuff he's not comfortable doing. He'll probably get a voice in what kind of plays and packages he's a part of, because they want him to be comfortable. So this has a chance to be a pretty good marriage. And I would imagine, I think Blunt's the guy whose playing time is in jeopardy here over the long haul. I think Ajayi will slowly wedge out Blunt, because they can do similar things, and Ajayi is a little more dynamic in how they do it.
Yeah. And on the other side of the ball here for the Broncos, it was Brock Osweiler back under center. That didn't really help. I saw Florio on the Sunday night show said the early reaction from the Broncos, they were happy that Osweiler took care of the ball. I watched most of this game. I disagree with that assessment. He threw two interceptions. He had at least two other balls that probably should have been intercepted. I don't think there was anyone thinking maybe Osweiler was the answer going forward, and it seems like they have three quarterbacks who are probably not the immediate answer. Maybe Paxton Lynch is long-term. Maybe Semien can sort of get back on track. But I guess what was so upsetting about this game is they gave up 51 points. Like, this defense is supposed to be carrying this team, and they were overwhelmed in this one.
And every team is going to have a faceplant game each year. I mean, I think every season on film you see this as well. It's just they having a bad day. This is probably Denver's faceplant game. The problem is they're not good enough to even have a chance to win in their faceplant games. The teams that can win when they have their faceplant games, and that's rare, but they're in a special class. Denver's not good enough offensively to overcome any sort of defensive woes. And really, your only saving grace, if you're a Broncos fan, is the fact that, remember when Paxton Lynch was coming out of Memphis, the book on him was he's going to need a lot of time. He is not close to ready. He is a project. So keep that in mind. It feels like he's a bust because why can't he play? These guys, these retread quarterbacks are playing ahead of him. But that's
just like,
all
just like part Jared Goff was a bust last year.
Well, and that was ridiculous. I mean, that was just people knee-jerking and having nothing to say. But in this case, I think that's all part of the original plan with Lynch. There's been nothing unexpected so far with Lynch relative to what he was coming into the league. You just wish he could get ready sooner, but that wasn't what was expected of him.
Yep. Boy, they have to figure out something. No, I mean, I don't know. If you're them, do you plug Lynch in for sort of the last third of the season here as sort of a see what you have? Do you have to go get another quarterback next offseason here?
Well, what are they're 3-5 now. I think you have to play who you have to. You're still in contention.
Play who you think is
best.
You got
to play with whoever. Yeah, so you play with whoever is best. Because keep in mind, the rest of the locker room, they know who's best. And if you're not playing who's best, you lose a team, and that's how you establish a losing culture.
Number six.
All right, topic number six, Andy. Rams just absolutely destroyed the Giants in East Rutherford. This was offensive dominance. No Janoris Jenkins for the Giants in this one. Suspended indefinitely. But, I mean, I don't know. This was this looked like, you know, some out-of-conference early season college game where, you know, Oklahoma plays, I don't know, Oral Roberts or something like that. I don't know if that matchup ever happens. But this was dominance. The Rams score points on 8 of their first 9 drives, and it was 48-10 midway through the third quarter. Rams are they're going to be all right.
Rams are a good team. They're a fun team to watch. They're incredibly well coached. They have a nice diversity of talent on offense. They're fast on defense. And they're winning games that they should be winning. I mean, they're playing up to their potential and then some. And there's been really no inconsistency. You know, their 2 losses, they were in it against Washington, and they outplayed Seattle and just happened to have some turnovers that they really paid a dear price for. So the Rams very well could be 7-1. They're a legitimate 6-2. And they've got who they have next week. They have the Texans, and then it's the Vikings and the Saints, and then the Eagles shortly after the Saints. So they're going to be playing these leading division teams one after another, and we're going to find out a lot about them then. But right now, this is a really quality NFL team.
Yeah, and screen game was huge in this one. They scored on a 3rd and 33, a wide receiver screen to Robert Woods that sort of started to break this game open. And then the next drive, and we've been talking about this, Andy, or I should say you've been talking about, because everyone in fantasy football is obviously very worried if Sammy Watkins is on their roster, because Sammy Watkins has not been statistically productive this year. And you said they have some designs for him, and next play, they go 67 yards. Play action, Sammy Watkins running down the middle of the field for the long touchdown. But this was an impressive offensive showing as far as the Giants go. We knew they weren't going to be much offensively going forward. It's a little bit concerning that the defense was so bad. This is one that they just want to burn the tape, specifically Landon Collins, who was featured in many highlights today. But not anything good for him.
By the way, has a team ever been like as screwed over on its bye week as the Rams were, because they flew back from London to Los Angeles? That's a long flight. That's not London to New York. That's London to New York and then New York to Los Angeles. That's a 10-hour flight, I would imagine. They flew back on the beginning of their bye week. I know they didn't get home until like almost Tuesday. They couldn't get to the office. And then to come out of their bye week, they have to fly to New York back across the country and play it on 10 a.m. body clock time. So not a great deal for the Rams there. But you know what? If they keep winning, they're going to learn something about unfavorable scheduling, because they're going to start getting flexed into some primetime games.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know how they actually handle travel from London to through the bye week to this one. So I was wondering if they were just going to stay on the East Coast somewhere.
No, not over your bye week, though. I mean, no, you wouldn't want to do that. Your players would hate you.
Well, then your
players' wives would hate you.
Just tell them have a nice vacation in New York. See the Halloween parade.
I don't think pro athletes think that way. I think they say, hey, I want to get hold of my personal masseuse. I want to see all these guys have kids in the age of your kids, Gary. I think Sean McVay would have lost the team if he'd done that.
Yeah. Well, whatever they did, it worked, because they won this one pretty easily. Okay, hang on 1 second, Andy. You know, if you're hiring, you know that quality hires keep your business moving forward, but you also know it can take a lot of time to find the right candidate for the job. That's where ZipRecruiter comes in. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click, so you can rest easy knowing that your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then, ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. You can even get a head start on the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post to help identify the most qualified candidates, so you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/things. That's ZipRecruiter.com/THINGS. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/things.
Number seven.
Okay, Andy, topic number seven. This is the red-hot New Orleans Saints, and it's the defense doing it right now.
If that defense is giving up in this six-game winning streak, just the defense, the points they're allowing, I think it's like 12.5 a game. And they look so fast every time you put on the film. They're playing fast. And what that, I think, stands out to me, what's really remarkable about it, is it's a high-volume scheme. Usually the teams that play fast, they run to the ball, they're all over the place, they swarm. Those are the zone teams that don't have a lot to think about. They line up and just play. The Saints have a lot to think about. Dennis Allen gives them a lot. They have a lot of different looks. They rotate coverages. They change up from zone to man here and there. Different designer blitzes. They do all these things, and yet here they are still playing fast. And with a bunch of young guys and guys who are relatively new to the team, it's quite an impressive showing right now. And if they keep this together, they're in contention.
Yeah, and this is sustainable at this point, it feels like.
As long as it is, if Marshawn Lattimore goes down, I think the whole house of cards falls with it. I think he is such a key piece to them, because when you play this way and you do a lot schematically, you need to have corners that win one-on-one, because otherwise you don't have the bodies to use in the disguises, or the guys to be your blitzers. Those have to become the help defenders. So you have to have guys that don't need help defenders. Lattimore has been that against anyone. I mean, true number one receivers. And I was a little surprised he did not travel with Mike Evans in this game. Now, when he got matched up against Evans, he got the better of him still. But all season long, Lattimore, for the most part, he's been traveling with number one receivers, and he wins those matchups week in and week out. And Ken Crawley's been playing aggressive across from him. When you have a great number one, which I think Lattimore has been, your number two can be a little bit more aggressive at times, and that really fits Ken Crawley, their cornerback. So a lot of things going well, but it stems from those one-on-one corners. And if they lose Lattimore, now they can't play one-on-one outside, and everything changes. But there's no sign that they'll lose them. Keep fingers crossed they'll stay here for 16 games.
Yep. And the offense obviously going to get done. Alvin Kamara, just neat to watch at this point.
Yeah, they got him on those Buccaneer linebackers all game long, and they did it out of the backfield more. We've seen him split out wide a lot, and they go to these empty formations. This game, they clearly felt better about attacking the Bucs linebackers from the backfield. Kamara, he's always the focal point early in the game. I bet you half of his catches have come in the first quarter this season. So they come out and they use him, they get dimensional with him, and now they have an expansive offense from there. And the other guy, by the way, Gary, who I was surprised, I am surprised that he's played so well, but he's legitimately fit into what they're doing, is Ted Ginn.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, you lose Brandon Cooks, and they really, it's like they haven't missed a beat offensively.
No, you're right.
Even though the defense has sort of been the story.
Yeah, I think they're winning the games on the strength of their defense, but I don't think that is to suggest their offense is anything less than it has always been. They have a great backfield screen game. Yeah, their offensive line has played very well this year. Andres Pete's having a phenomenal season. Teron Armstead was not in this game today, but when he's been out there, he's been an upper-tier left tackle. They're good at right tackle. They're good at center. You know, this is a really complete offense, counterbalanced now by a defense that's shutting people down.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the real headline in this game, Andy, which was the WrestleMania that broke out on the sideline. I mean, my first issue was with this is Jameis Winston's nursing the injured shoulder at this point. So why is he basically walking onto the field? And I don't know exactly what he was pointing at or why it was Lattimore specifically he was going after, but he sort of set this whole thing off by he was pointing to something and sort of tried to make it into the, Like, oh, I just happened to be pointing my finger here and you walked into my space type of thing. But he had clearly walked up and sort of jabbed with his finger Lattimore in the back of the head. Lattimore took exception, gives Winston a little shove. Again, that's why Jameis Winston, with your injured shoulder, you maybe shouldn't be picking a fight. And then, Mike Evans with the all-out just running clear out of Lattimore at that point.
I think there's two separate things here. I think the Winston is a little bit under the boys will be boys category, and yeah, you probably don't want to see your quarterback being a boy like that, though. Not you know, he's got to be above that stuff a little bit. And then
well,
I think
he's got the injured shoulder. So if right, Lattimore but, I mean, decides he to turn around and deck him.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't think you count on that. I mean, has that ever happened in the history of the NFL? I mean, maybe. I mean, maybe you think about that, but I think it's what Mike Evans did that's totally separate, and that does not go under the boys will be boys category. That was a ridiculous cheap shot. I think he should be suspended one game for it.
Yeah, I don't think it's a very difficult decision.
Why wasn't he ejected?
NFL?
Well, the NFL already had the decision to kick him out of this game, and then maybe you don't need to suspend him, and they didn't. They let him stay in.
Blandino on the telecast had said that they can't get video help on that, on the ejection. So I'm wondering if just, you know, the official, you know, the ball is somewhere else. The officials are not looking at that part of the sideline, and they basically just missed the whole thing. If that is the case, I mean, I have no idea why New York draws the line there, that they won't get involved in that sort of play. But
that could be a Pandora's box thing. I mean, the NBA, I believe the NBA does have video review on fighting, and it takes forever. It takes forever. Yeah. And so then, and it would have been nice, like Lee Smith, that unsportsmanlike conduct foul he had, the Raiders tight end against Miami, that would have been nice to have video review on, because Lee Smith didn't do anything. He's right. Yeah. He was kidding around. But there were probably 40 other plays today that would be reviewable if we're reviewing Evans and Lee Smith. And we can't have that. I mean, that's going to take 10 more minutes a game. That's too bad entertainment-wise. You can't have that. You don't agree?
It seems very the game's already stopped. They're already having the review. They're already having the conversation. I just don't see why someone in New York, they're flying by the seat of their pants to an extent anyway. There's enough judgment calls in you know, the day of an official anyway, where you can't just say, oh, by the way, none of you guys saw it because the ball was on the other side of the field. But Mike Evans just absolutely, tried to murder Marshawn Lattimore. Let's toss him out of the game.
Well, you know what they could do and what I would espouse they do? I think you have to keep it as it is with the rules, but break the rules. So when they call in and they're trying, I think it was Vinovich was the referee in this game. Alberto Riveron, the head of officiating in New York, is talking to Vinovich. He also says, all right, here's whatever we're going over, but oh, by the way, and I know we're not supposed to do this, throw Mike Evans out of the game. Just say one of you guys saw it. And lie to people, because no one's going to find them out. No one's going to find out. No one's going to raise an issue if they do it, because it was the right thing to do. So
yes.
Is that what you're saying they should be doing?
Yes.
Because you don't want like an official review process. Like, you wouldn't want Fox to bring in Mike Pereira to break down a fist fight every time they do it if you're the NFL. You don't want to make that actually reviewable. You want to just say it's not reviewable and then cheat when you can to help yourself.
Yes. If you're already on with New York, I'm not saying stop the play every time there's a shoving match. I'm saying if you're already on with New York, which they were on this play.
I'm with you on that. I think if you're already on with New York on something like this, probably on any kind of thing. What's the harm of doing that on anything that's obvious if they can clean up the game like that? And so we're on the same page there. Anytime they can streamline this and let New York make the call, because New York's going to be so much faster every time because they go right to the perfect video angle of it. That's what they need to be doing in the NFL. They need to have
very
New York
pro
make a lot
big
of
brother.
These calls.
Yes.
I am. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess I could see some wiggle room with the suspension if he was ejected from this game, but it feels like, and we'll talk about AJ Green in a little bit, you know, it feels like since they basically missed any punishment for him, I mean, he got a 15-yard penalty, which, you know, in a what was a 4-touchdown game at that point anyway, isn't really much of a penalty. But since he got no punishment during this game, it seems, you know, in sort of the NFL's system of justice, that suspend him for the next game. That's the punishment.
I would agree with it.
All right. We figured it out. You're welcome, Park
Solved.
Avenue.
Yep.
Number eight.
Topping number eight, Cardinals and 49ers. Adrian Peterson. Adrian Peterson had 37 carries. Do you know that was a career high for him?
I did, because I watched every snap of this game, and they announced that he was on pace for a career high at some point in the fourth quarter. And
yep.
He was a bell cow in this one. I mean, and every carry was behind Alex Boone on just straight inside zone pretty much.
Yeah. No, this was it was nice to see Adrian Peterson have some success. I know he's kind of not he's not what the NFL looks for in running backs anymore, and you know, when it's when his legs are completely gone, he'll have no role in the league. But it was nice to see that he can still do it.
Yeah, he still has some short area burst. He has what he's always been great at is moving laterally with strength and explosiveness in confined areas. And he's not quite as explosive as he used to be. Nothing's as twitchy as it used to be, but it's still there, and it's still in the plus column. And if he were a rookie coming out and you'd never heard of the guy, you'd say, "Whoa, man, who is this guy doing that?" Because he still looks different. So he can work for how they're going to play with their running game. You know, they're 4-4, Gary. I know everyone's writing off Arizona, and I understand that, and I probably am too. They're not writing themselves off. It'll be interesting to see what this offense becomes and if they do turn into more of this run-oriented offense, because Peterson doesn't fit their passing game, but their passing game doesn't fit itself now because Carson Palmer's gone.
Yep. Andy, tell me everything else you liked from this game or didn't like.
That was about it. I know you teased me for watching every snap of it.
Yes, I
but,
did.
That was about it from this one. Niners, look, the Niners are an 0-9 team. I've seen all their snaps this season. They don't play like, I mean, they're not an embarrassment. They're a bad team, or they're a rebuilding team with some bad deficiencies, but they're just losing games, and it's really not a whole lot more than that. So I don't mind watching Niner games.
Well, I say I fear for C.J. Beathard, because he takes just huge shot after huge shot over the course of a game.
And he did in this one, too.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
some
of
that's on him. Some of that's on him. Some of it's on the offensive line. They had a lot of backups in. Arizona smelled blood. They brought edge blitzes. And then when those started getting picked up, they came inside with double A gap blitzes. And Beathard took a shot on almost every single one of those. He got nailed in this one.
Yeah. I worry about his health, but you know, look, Jimmy Garoppolo's there. Clearly, C.J. Beathard only has so many starts left until Garoppolo is under center. So I guess he's trying to make the most of it. What do you think of the Garoppolo trade? By the way, we had it happened in midweek, so we didn't talk about it.
I like it for San Francisco, given that's a good risk and a good gamble to take with a draft pick, and they have so many draft picks at their disposal. I thought I understood it. I thought it made sense.
Okay.
What about you?
I'll add this because I'm too much of a coward to actually put it in writing, because we actually pulled it. Emily Kaplan, I was her editor on the big Johnny Manziel story. I guess that was two off seasons ago now. I can't even remember anymore. But we talked to a lot of people who were in the Browns building at that time. That was Kyle Shanahan's offense with the Browns at that point. And people we talked to and we took with a grain of salt, we actually held it back from the story because we felt it was probably a lot of revisionist history because no one wants to say like, oh, yeah, I love Johnny Manziel coming out of college. And everyone on the staff loved him. And that's how we took him. If that was the case, no one would fess up to it. But
yeah.
People, coaches on that staff said they all wanted Garoppolo. They thought Garoppolo was the better prospect. They thought, you know, Manziel was sort of the guy that ownership was pushing, and they all wanted Garoppolo, and they ended up taking Manziel. So now Kyle Shanahan gets Jimmy Garoppolo. So
that's consistent with what I've heard about ownership and Manziel in that draft that year.
Yeah. Yep. The whole reason we held it back was because we didn't want our 4,000 word story to be boiled down into basically one quote.
Well, that's how stories are supposed to go now. I would think we'd all know that by now. I guess this was 2 years ago. We weren't as wise and stupid at the same time as we are now with the way stories go.
Mm-hmm.
Number nine.
Topping number nine, Andy. Lightning is round. What? This is where the wisdom really comes out. Three more games to get to here. We'll start with Bengals and Jaguars. Jaguars were good again. No Leonard Fournette, and they win with this one. We don't have any more detail on Fournette, just he was suspended for breaking a team rule. Blake Bortles was fine in this one. The Jaguars were fine. The Bengals were not so fine. Jaguars were very good defensively again. And by the way, Jaguars 12 for 18 on third downs, which is a very impressive number to put up. The AJ Green.
Let's talk about the fight.
Yeah, Jalen Ramsey. That was.
I just rewatched the video. I don't think this compares to the. To me, the most satisfying wide receiver cornerback fight in history was the time Andre Johnson just wailed on Cortland Finnegan.
Yep.
Because everybody who's ever watched Cortland Finnegan has wanted someone to do that to him at some point, and Johnson finally did it. You know, Ramsey's not that kind of guy. I mean, he's probably not a joy to play against, and Green got impatient, and Green decided, all right, here it goes. I mean, he went and headlocked him to start the whole thing off. And this was a planned attack by A.J. Green, so to speak, but it was not as satisfying as Andre Johnson just punching Cortland Finnegan into oblivion.
Yeah, it just all – it really – again, obviously there's a conversation going back and forth. A.J. Green's a very mild-mannered guy. You would not expect this, and it was not. It was just sort of like it was like Green put a hand on him, and Ramsey sort of gave him a not that big a two hand shove back, and it seemed like Green sort of was a little bit off balance and stumbled because of that. But he had just had it, I guess, because it was a chokehold takedown, and then a couple punches, and then they got back up, and then he did the same thing again, and that was he got his money's worth on that.
Yeah, and he'll be given some other money's worth on it. And, you know, he's quiet, but when you watch it, he gets a little pouty when the ball's not going to him, as any receiver does. And he can get frustrated, and he's always had trouble dealing with his frustration on the field. I remember the Bills game a few weeks ago where he was responsible for a bunch of turnovers. On one of those, he just didn't even chase the guy on the run back. He let the guy run away from him because he was too busy pouting in the middle of the field. So on field, I don't want to call it behavior, but just Green stuff will get under his skin a little bit, and I think that's always been something they've had to deal with in Cincinnati, not in a horrendous way, just in a you got to pick AJ up every once in a while kind of way. And today AJ his actions broke out before anyone had a chance to pick him up.
Yeah, and suspend or no suspend?
No suspend, not on that. Okay. I know he was punching Ramsey, but that was different. That was not violent and totally blindsided cheap the way Mike Evans, remember, he came in running full speed. So he had time to figure out what he was doing there. That wasn't just the heat of the moment with Mike Evans. That was a really planned attack. AJ Green, he kind of just, I called it a planned attack, but that wasn't, I guess I shouldn't have said that.
Well, the A.J. Green thing, I mean, Jalen Ramsey couldn't have been surprised that A.J. Green was upset at that point, and he also knew where A.J. Green was in relation to him, as opposed to Lattimore has his back turned, and all of a sudden a guy comes sprinting at him and clears him out. So
Yeah, it wasn't even Evans' fight. At least Ramsey and Green were going head-to-head.
Yeah.
We should not do fights on Lightning Round because we like it too much, and we're like 5 minutes into this is why Lightning Round's horrendous. I hate it.
Well, it's a shorter Lightning Round because again, it was the six-team bye week this week, so only two more games here, Andy. Next one's the Colts and the Texans. Tom Savage back under center with Deshaun Watson out. He had them in position to potentially win this game late, but Tom Savage is. You know, if you squint, he does not look like Deshaun Watson.
No, he does not. That was too bad to see. That changes the entire dynamic of that offense. I mean, it changes the offense completely. And I know this is probably not the kind of thing to just say at the end of the show. And people who listen to the show know I'm not a Kaepernick guy from a football standpoint. But given how good Houston had gotten in the misdirection stuff with Watson, mm-hmm. part of you wonders if maybe going and getting Kaepernick wouldn't have been the smart move there, because you can at least keep the misdirection offense in place. Kaepernick's not nearly the player Watson is, but that's one I think there's a discussion to be had. They decided they want to go to someone, a known entity, and they've gone to Tom Savage instead. So they're going to have to play a different way, but they've played that way before.
Yeah, and Jacoby Brissett, a couple long touchdowns to T.Y. Hilton, including one 80-yarder with a little play on that I hated, where T.Y. Hilton dove mid-run. It was already a big gain. He dove and pretended to be down, and no one touched him, and then he got back up and ran some more, which I think...
Did he do that? That's genius. I didn't see that play.
If someone comes in and... my problem with that play, it's fine, and it worked, and look, it was a good idea. But
aren't you giving yourself up, though, when you do that? If
yes.
you die, that's the same as sliding.
And it's, if someone had come in and you know, dropped an elbow on his spine at that point, they'd be flagged. That's my problem with that
whole... The Colts did this back in 2003, I think, when they just blew the doors off the Broncos in the playoffs. I forget who I think it was Marvin Harrison that caught a ball
yep.
and nobody touched him and he got up and ran. And that's exactly what John Lynch said to the referee. He said, if we had come in and touched him hard, you would have thrown a flag. That was his argument.
No,
the ref
there was a play.
Some form of you got to touch him more than not at all.
There's a play, Cardinals Ravens, a couple years ago. Chris Johnson was
basically Monday night.
Falling over. I think it was Brandon Williams, actually. And if someone came in and finished him off, it was a definite flag. They got to be better with player safety thing. I guess the Chris Johnson thing is another thing that I shouldn't have brought up, because his knee didn't actually touch. But knee touches, just blow the play dead. Do it the college way. We don't need guys.
No. That's a separate discussion. But no, come on. No, that's a dumb rule. The knee touches, you're down.
How often does that happen, though? How often do guys slip down and then get up and do anything of note?
Well, but what about how often do we see guys that get wide open, make a diving catch, and then get up and make a meaningful run? I like that you have to
Not
touch them
often.
Down in the NFL.
I hate it. It's a player safety thing, Andy. I'm thinking of the players.
You know what? If you're going to make that, I might go with you on that. If that's the direction you take it, player safety. That would be the way to win the argument, but then that's a slippery slope. Then that's the path to flag football.
No, there aren't enough plays of guys going down, getting back up, and running. Even diving catches. How many diving catches, is a guy open enough to make the diving catch and then get up and then do something of significance? It just the cost reward there is. It's in my favor, whatever it is.
Discussion over. I'll think about it some more.
Ravens and Titans. This was Titans hang on in this one. They didn't really get the run game going. So I guess this is a nice one for them to win. Ravens, as usual, having similar issues to what they've had offensively all year, but this was a win for the Titans coming off their bye week.
I didn't see a lot of this one. I will say there are just some like teams where you like to see their uniforms on the field together. And I've always felt that way about Ravens Titans. Remember those great AFC playoff games they used to have in the Ray Lewis era?
Yeah.
Eddie George versus Ray Lewis. Those were some phenomenal games. And I always get old tinklings of that part of my teenage childhood when I see it. And don't worry, folks. I'll watch the film on this one. And if it's important, we'll talk about it next week.
There you go. All right. I thought you were going to say you just liked the uniforms. I was about to rail
no,
against
the
Titans.
No, the Titans, I think they wore their light blue pants today, wasn't it? And dark blue tops. They don't do that very often. I don't know if they've ever done that, in fact.
I watched that game, and I can't remember what they wore.
Number 10.
Weekly awards, Andy. Topic number 10, Offensive Player of the Week. Who are you giving it to?
I think I'll claim Jared Cook. He had a very nice game, and he was part of the game plan, and he capitalized on that for Oakland.
Too many cooks. I'm giving it to Kirk Cousins for, again, just incredibly unlikely. I mean, they couldn't block anyone. Cliff Averill, he's out. Dwight Freeney against TJ Clemmings was exactly the mismatch as you would expect it to be. And Kirk Cousins somehow pulls this one out with the with a late drive after getting drilled all game. So nice win for Kirk Cousins. Defensive player of the week.
I'm going to go with Cam Jordan for the Saints, more because of what he represents. And this is kind of a season-long achievement award, so to speak, because he was not demonstrative in this game against the Bucks, but he has had a sensational season. Every time you watch Saints film, he wins early in the down. He especially wins late in the down. He is a really, really good football player. I don't think he's super explosive. He's gotten more explosive over time. He's gotten quicker. He's very mechanically sound. He's honed that even more. But he's not a twitchy Von Miller type around the edge. Mm-hmm. And yet he still takes over games every single week. And we've talked about how good that Saints defense has been. As much as I love Lattimore, Cam Jordan's still the best player on that defense.
I'm going to give it to DeMarcus Lawrence. I don't think he had a sack today, but I was surprised. I thought they were going to be, for the most part, neutralized by that Chiefs line. I thought Lawrence versus Mitchell Schwartz was a really good matchup that I thought Schwartz would get a little bit better of. And Schwartz did have his moments, but Lawrence also had a couple plays where he just went directly to Alex Smith and disrupted plays. So this was a kind of a award for the entire Cowboys line, but I'll give it to Lawrence here. Special teams player of the week, Andy, who do you have?
I am going with Michael Thomas for the Dolphins because I learned tonight he subbed out on third downs for undrafted rookie Maurice Smith. And according to Chris Collinsworth, the reason Michael Thomas, and he's a Dolphins safety, is now filling in with Nate Allen's out with a calf injury, and TJ McDonald's finishing up his suspension. So Michael Thomas, who's been a good backup and a fill-in safety over the years, he's filling in, but he comes out on third down so he can rest up for special teams. That's how valuable he is on special teams, according to Collinsworth, who I'm sure got that information from the Dolphins. I've never heard of that, and I'm going to go Michael Thomas, special teams player of the week for the rest of my life now.
That's actually a really good special teams player of the week, although I will get tired of it come like week 15 or so. I am giving mine to Brandon McManus, Broncos kicker, returns home to Philadelphia. This is really the story of the day. Hits the 52-yarder to open the scoring and really gets the Broncos momentum going in that game. So, Philadelphia native doing it in his hometown.
They lost by like 30-something points.
Yeah, but it was a nice thing for McManus. He gave away a bunch of tickets, had a bunch of family in attendance there.
I did better on special teams player award than you this week. Well, come on. I had a better special teams award than you this week.
We both should have given it to Cody Parkey for recovering his own onside kick, but he'll have to do that again if he wants one of these awards. Coach of the week, Andy, who do you have?
Coach of the week. You know, Jack Del Rio had his guys stay in Florida. So he's had those guys on the road for 2 weeks. They were in Buffalo, and they flew down to Florida and stayed there and then won a Sunday night game in Miami. You know, that's a tough schedule to do, and that's a big decision for a coach to make. Do you do that? Because, I mean, think from the player standpoint how much that impacts them and how much repercussion there is in the locker room. You want your veterans to be comfortable. You want them to be – we talked about McVay and Walsh, should the Rams stay in New York over their bye week. I mean, that's a little bit – it's not the bye week, but Del Rio had to make that tough decision, and it worked out well for him.
Yeah. I am going to give it to – I'll give it to Mike Shula. They just did a lot of neat things for like the first three quarters of this game against Atlanta. They pulled out all the stops. I will give it to any coach who calls a Statue of Liberty play in any game this year. So just let that be known. If you want this award, call one Statue of Liberty play, and I will automatically give it to you. That's going to do it. Thanks, as always, to producers Shelby Royston and Lou Pellegrino, as well as editor Chris Basil, all the folks at Cadence 13 who make us sound so good all the time. But more than that, thank you to you for listening to this episode of the Mammon QB 10 Things podcast. You guys really are the best. We want to know how we can make the show better, or what we do well. We presumably do some things well. So you can contact us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. We are both on Facebook. You can also get us at talkback@themqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this show, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.